Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Ramis Kent, a permaculture teacher and designer originally from the United States, who currently lives in the United Kingdom and teaches in Africa and the Middle East. He joins me today to begin the series on faith and earth care. During this conversation, we discuss his background, the ideas of law and ethics, the core tenets of Islam, and how these relate to our being stewards of the earth. We wrap things up by talking more about ethics and land care. Even though Ramis is a practicing Muslim, we talk about Islam and faith in an academic and largely secular fashion, divorced from the geopolitics one might hear in the news. There's a great deal of value in this interview for anyone who wants to understand and engage others to build greater community and, in turn, a better world. This conversation is the first of at least two, possibly three, with Ramis, and serves as an introduction to what will follow. As Ramis and I spent around 6 hours talking over two different days, the tone of this conversation is considerably more open, friendly, and jovial than I have had in most of the previous interviews. That led to a show that is quite different from the norm. And also because of that, I went on some tangents a couple times, so you'll hear two cuts in the middle where I removed a couple minutes of me just rambling on. Another difference is also that, because of how long we spoke this first time, I ran up against a hard deadline that day and had to stop the conversation a bit abruptly. No worries though, I think you'll be able to enjoy this just the same. If you do, consider making a donation to help keep this podcast going. Find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. While you're there, you can also find out how to follow the show on Facebook and Twitter. Now then, on to Ramis Kent. I'll join you afterwards with some thoughts and updates. So then, Mr. Kent, if you're ready, could you give us a bit of your background and biography? I'm interested in knowing how you became an American living in the United Kingdom and doing what you do now.
My name's Ramis Kent. I'm currently, working primarily as a trainer and a consultant, doing, permaculture design, regenerative design. My formal background is in mechanical engineering. I got my bachelor's in 1995. At the University of Delaware, and I worked several years in that field, mostly medical-related consumer products, and did a year of aerospace, and then figured I didn't like working in an office, so I needed to get out of that. I taught high school a couple of years. I taught algebra and physics in high school and discovered, permaculture actually while I was working in one of my sort of education-related jobs. I was helping to run an Arabic language intensive at what is now known as Zaytuna College. I helped to run their first Arabic intensive in 2008. I happened to meet someone who worked for Jeff Lawton, who had enrolled in that course, and they had shown me some of the work he had been doing and introduced me to this whole idea of permaculture. And then I actually had a chance to meet him not long after that. He happened to be coming to the San Francisco Bay Area. And from meeting Jeff and Nadia, I actually came to find out he knew some old friends of mine, and that sort of cemented things for me to actually go to Australia and train. But I'm originally from New York, but I kind of claim the San Francisco Bay Area as home. But I'm currently living in the southwest of the United Kingdom in Cornwall, and I'm here because my wife is British, and we live here with our four children. And I travel out of the UK, working mostly internationally, mostly in North Africa, the Middle East, East Africa, Central and South Asia, and Southeast Asia as well.
Did you grow up knowing Arabic? Was it taught and spoken in your household, or was that something that you learned later?
My being exposed to Arabic, introduced to Arabic, is actually a product of my becoming a Muslim not quite 15 years ago. One of the things that is a part of the faith is at least having some working understanding of, some functional understanding of how Arabic works as far as, being able to read, being able to write it. I don't have conversational Arabic. The reason why I was asked to help administer the course is because I'm very familiar with the people that happen to run the institution that runs Zaytuna. I've been involved in that community for a number of years, and I was just asked to help stabilize some things in terms of the logistics of the course and the like. But Arabic is something that I've come to pick up in my travels. I'd lived early on with Arabs or Arabic speaking people not long after I become Muslim. And it was just something that I started to pick up by ear. And it's something that I continue to try to get better at learning and understanding. It's sort of a lifelong process. It's a very deep language. Technically, it's a fascinating language. And it's something that hopefully I'll be able to study more in depth in the coming years.
I had a friend who was fluent in Arabic after studying at the Defense Language Institute. And it was always interesting talking with him about Arabic, because one of the fellows in his class spoke Arabic with a Texas accent. And he said it was the funniest thing in the world.
It's a fascinating language. I mean, especially when you meet Arabs or Arabic speaking people, I should say, you know, from different parts of, you know, the Muslim world. So, you know, people all throughout Africa speak Arabic, or they speak some variant of Arabic. They speak, you know, certain dialects. So if you go to West Africa, you'll find people in places like Mauritania. They'll speak something called Hassaniya. Then you'll hear, you know, what people speak in Morocco. They speak Darija. You'll hear the way people speak in Egypt and Yemen or Syria. Everybody has sort of they have a certain accent or a certain cadence to how they speak the language. I mean, there's like a standard sort of classical Arabic that's called Fusha. But then there are the variants off of the standard, probably similar to what we have, you know, in English. There's the, you know, the kind of the King's English or the Queen's English, which would be sort of old English that's spoken in England. But, you know, one of the things I've learned as an American being in England is I don't speak English, I speak American. And I think, you know, it's very similar to what you'll find among Arabic speaking peoples, is that they speak variants, they speak variations of the classical language, although some variations are closer to classical Arabic than others.
That's interesting. I think about just in the United States, I happen to grow up in Western Maryland, and being one of those states that kind of borders the North versus the South, the further north I got, the more Southern my accent was. And the further south I got, the more northern it was. So it was this by degrees.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I went to college in Delaware, so I can remember the, you know, we kind of pick up that kind of Baltimore, that mid-Atlantic kind of dialect and that accent. You know, you don't say Saturday, you say Saturday, you know, if it's Baltimore, right? Or Baltimore has a very interesting, it's kind of dialectical variation on English. I mean, it's probably, you know, similar to my growing up in the Northeast. I grew up in New York. So it's like the difference between what people sound like in New York and people sound like in Boston, people sound like in Philadelphia. Those variations are, you know, are those different colors, those different textures you get in the language. You can see how those things carry over, you know, to other parts of the world with other languages. They are sort of colored by place and culture and the like.
Are you familiar with the idea of a shibboleth?
I'm familiar with the term.
That's one of the things that I think about as you mentioned those different, the different dialects, even within, you know, we talk about English or Arabic. The first time that I went to college. Well, yes. Well, I've been in and out a couple of times, but I went to a school in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and we could tell who the visitors were or who were new to the area based on their pronunciation of words, because it's Lancaster, but to people who live there, but most people would pronounce it Lancaster.
Right.
There are other words because of the spelling that are used. One that comes to mind as a local town is spelled P-E-Q-U-E-A. And you write that out and it's like, how would you say this? Pequa, Pequo? And for everybody who lives here, we just know it's Pequay.
Right.
That idea of a shibboleth is that it identifies people and where they're from based on their language. And that's just an academic kind of thing that is of interest to me.
It's funny. I mean, I think you'll find a very, you know, very similar things in, you know, in the Arab speaking world. So for example, if you go to Egypt, they pronounce the Arabic letter jim, they pronounce it g. So, you know, we have jokes about the Egyptians wouldn't say Egypt with the j sound. They would say it with a g. So you say Egyptian. That's a kind of a joke, you know, about the Egyptians, because they pronounce jim g. If you go to Yemen, the Yemeni, they pronounce the Arabic letter kaf, which is the q sound, kaf. They pronounce kaf g. So the Arabic word for heart, which is qalb, they wouldn't say qalb, they would say galb. You're able to identify people from what regions they come from based on, again, the pronunciation of certain letters. or sort of, again, the cadence of how they speak the language. So people from Syria, they tend to have a very sort of sing-songy, very mellifluous way of speaking the Arabic language. Whereas people from, again, if you go to a place like West Africa, you go to, you know, Mauritania, they speak very, very, it's a very kind of hard, kind of precise, strong pronunciation of sounds in the language. So again, you can identify people from the different regions based on how they speak.
My original, again, the first time that I went to college, my original major was sociology and anthropology. I was looking at a dual degree before I became a computer scientist.
Computer science, yes.
We have to put science in the name because it's not really a science. I joke that it's one part science, one part mathematics, and probably three parts witchcraft.
Right. I remember having to compile programs in like Fortran 77, and I still don't understand how that stuff works.
With how easygoing this conversation is, we could go all kinds of places with it, but we are ultimately here to talk about Islam and ethics and earth care. Or at least those are the words that I'm using right now to kind of think about framing this. The only other question that I have before we get into that is based on some of the things that you said before we began the interview proper. I was just wondering, without needing to get too far into the details, and I don't mean this to pry into your life too much, I was just wondering what attracted you to Islam, because you said that you did convert to the faith.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about my becoming a Muslim was that when I actually had a chance to find out what Muslims actually believe, divorced from a lot of the sort of political and cultural baggage that often is attached to the faith itself, I didn't hear anything that I wasn't already inclined to believe to begin with. So like it was almost by default, I was like, it's not like I don't believe any of those things. So I guess by default, I'm from among these people. So I think the way Islam was explained to me, at least the way that I had come to understand it, it was sort of like the last leg of a relay race that began with, as far as the Abrahamic faiths, it began with Judaism, and then the baton was passed on to Christianity, and then the prophetic cycle, if you will, as it applies to the Abrahamic faiths, was completed with the advent of Islam. So when I, again, heard sort of the articles of faith about what it is that makes a Muslim, what Islam was about in terms of its core tenets, everything that I heard, I was like, yeah, I believe that. So it wasn't difficult for me. It actually felt very natural. It was like a no-brainer for me. But again, I think the important thing about that, though, is that it wasn't, again, it wasn't attached to any of the other things that people typically think about when you hear the word Islam. And there's all this other stuff that's thrown into the mix, you know. So typically, you know, think of some sort of kind of swarthy, bearded person in kind of outlandish clothes and strange accents, or I mean, what have you. And then again, that they're sort of associated with certain, you know, geopolitical leanings or certain cultural leanings. And that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the faith. I think you have to separate the faith from the people. You know, there's Islam and there's Muslims, the people who supposedly follow Islam. They're not the same thing. You know, there's like, they're Christians and there's Christianity. They're not the same thing. There's Judaism and there's Jews. They're not the same thing. So once you're able to actually have an explanation of what the faith is about, once I learned what that was about, again, it was very easy for me. It was very clear.
It's part of why I wanted to have this series of interviews that I'm doing about faith and earth care, was to help people understand the religions that people follow and a way that they can use that to inform their own life practices. Because of the way that religion forms a philosophical underpinning for the way that we live our lives, for many people, I studied Islam from a secular perspective, from a historical perspective, when I was looking at the modern Middle East in a history course, in order to understand the geopolitical developments of the modern Middle East, because of the cultural impact that it had, Islam was a major part of that. And our studies really started with the birth of Muhammad as the beginning. I apologize. Is there an appropriate way for me to refer to the prophet?
Yeah, you know, the prophet Muhammad. And then typically, you know, whenever prophets are mentioned, there's usually a sort of a saying, kind of an honorific saying that's repeated after, you know, the mentioning of their name. So, for example, if we say the prophet Jesus, for instance, we usually say in Arabic, we say alayhi salam, or peace be upon him. When we mention the prophet Muhammad, we say sallallahu alayhi wasallam, the peace and blessings be upon him. It's considered to be proper etiquette or proper manners, given the, you know, sort of the stature or the status of those people. It's kind of giving them their just due.
At this point in the conversation, I took things sideways and shared a rather personal story with Ramis about my own questions regarding religion and interpretation of texts and scripture, which started us on the road to talk about ethics and faith.
And one of the things that hopefully what comes across in the conversation is that a lot of, I think, what is really being communicated in each of our respective faith traditions is that there's a certain kind of comportment, there's a certain behavior, there's a certain way of being, a standard of being that is befitting the human being, and that the human being has been created or made into something that is noble, and that we have a certain standard of behavior that we need to uphold that is befitting what we've been made. And that is something in Arabic, they call it adab. It's manners, it's etiquette. Really, I think any religion or any faith tradition at its core is really about adab. It's really about having proper manners towards God and towards what God has created. And that any trouble that we experience in life or in this reality, in this plane, if you will, is a result of violating those manners, by violating those ethics, not observing proper manners that are befitting, again, what we've been made within kind of this form that we've been put in, you know, the human form. The problem with religion, in particular, when we start talking about kind of law as it applies to religion, religious, you know, kind of rulings that are rendered from like textual sources, you know, relating to certain faiths, is that when law is divorced from ethics, if law is not informed by ethics, then law is no longer a tool to, well, in Islam, there's sort of two poles. There's what they call maslaha and mafsada, like benefit and harm. And really, the purpose of the Sharia existing is to be able to move within the confines of this, you know, these two poles of benefit and harm, trying to maximize benefit and minimize harm. Is that discussion or those rules, the implementation of those things, has to be joined with ethics. Otherwise, the rules become a weapon. So it's just like any tool. A tool can go from being something that's beneficial to being made a weapon. I could take a screwdriver and I could screw in a screw with the screwdriver. I could also take the screwdriver and I could fashion it into a weapon and I could start shanking somebody with it. What separates the two potential uses is the intent behind the use of the tool. And I think the same thing goes with the use of religious law, is that depending on the intent of the use of the law, is you can take something that was originally supposed to have very beneficial uses, and then you use it to beat people over the head with it. You use it to oppress people. You use it to really wreak havoc. And depending on the intent, and intention is something that's very big within Islam. And that was actually one of the more famous quotes from the Prophet Muhammad, is that he said that actions are judged according to their intentions. And of course, the acts need to be in accord with the intention, and you do your best to try to bring those intentions into reality to whatever extent you have within your capacity to, you know, perform. But intention is a very major part of how we go about living our lives, is that we have to be very, very clear about the intentions which fuel our actions. And I think that that's very much a part of, you know, how you understand the way in which law or the rules are created and are put to use.
And here is another cut in the show where I started talking about my own life and what it's like coming from a family of storytellers. We pick up again with Ramis talking about stories and compelling narratives.
I'm big on narrative myself. I've been sort of hammering on the importance of narrative and a lot of, you know, the work that we're trying to do is that the thing that ultimately moves people are narratives, they're stories. If you can fashion the stories in a way that, you know, it's compelling and it makes people want to listen and it makes people want to get involved, and then that's really where the rubber hits the road. I mean, that's the story of the Western world, really, is narrative. I mean, it's, you know, why is Hollywood so influential? You know, why is television or radio or, you know, anything that is sort of popular or, you know, has as much strength, culturally speaking, you know, what is it about those things that move people? And it's, they have very interesting stories, they have very interesting narratives that are attached to the people that are involved with those activities. So I think, you know, we have to do the same thing with what it is that we're doing and the work we're trying to engage ourselves in.
I think we've touched on a lot of things that will be very useful for people in their efforts to communicate permaculture. Yeah, we've only spent maybe 10 minutes talking about the core ideas of this conversation.
We can jump into it. I mean, just let me know.
What I'd like to do is, because you've mentioned the core tenets of Islam, as well as that idea of law divorced from ethics and how we need to use ethics to inform our position, could you go back and then and touch on the core tenets of Islam and lead us into that conversation about permaculture and ethical earth care?
Islam is again, it's, you know, it's one of the three, you know, major Abrahamic faiths. It's really seen as being, at least from the standpoint of the Muslims, it's a completion of the prophetic cycle that began with, you know, Abraham, and for us ends with the Prophet Muhammad. But it also includes Jesus. So, you know, I can say as a person who was a Christian, it doesn't in any way, shape, or form contradict anything that I learned as a Christian. If anything, it completes a lot of those understandings. But it also allows for the possibility of there being other prophetic figures or other divinely inspired dispensations that aren't necessarily covered within the three major Abrahamic faiths. So, you know, it could cover the Buddha, or it could cover Lao Tzu or Confucius or the prophets that were sent to the Aboriginal peoples or the native peoples of the Americas or what have you. Because what we're told within Islam, you know, within the Quran, it tells us that all peoples were sent messengers. All human communities were sent messengers of some kind. They all come from the same source, at least those that we would consider to be legitimate. So the tenets of Islam are the three basic sort of branches. There's what we call Islam, which is literally the uttering of the article of faith, which is in Arabic, we say, La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. La ilaha illallah is there's nothing worthy of worship except for Allah, which is literally the deity, right? The God, the one and only God. Al being a definite article in Arabic and La being God or deity in Arabic. So, you know, Christian Arabs call God Allah. So just to, you know, make that clear. Then there's Iman, which is translated roughly into faith. So these are the articles of faith, the things that you believe as a Muslim, which is you believe in the prophets, you believe in the books, right? These are all of the divine dispensations. So this would cover the Torah. This would cover the what's called the Injil or the Gospels. This would cover the Zabur, what's called the Psalms. Of course, the Quran, you know, all of the divine dispensations that have been passed along to human beings. You believe in the angels, like the unseen realm, the unseen world, which would include angels and what's called the jinn, right? So, you know, like the genie in the lamp. Well, that term refers to as the jinn. You believe in the heaven, right? Heaven or paradise, and you believe in the fire or hell, the existence of those things. You believe in, of course, God, Allah, the one God. You believe in the last day, the day of judgment, what's called in Arabic the Yom al-Qiyamah. You believe in what's called the Qadr, or the decree of God, both the good and the bad of it. Or what I should say is that which you like and that which you don't necessarily prefer. And then lastly, there's a term called ihsan, which is loosely translated into excellence. And basically, ihsan is where what's more popularly referred to as Sufism. That's where Sufism sort of emanates from, or what's called in Arabic tasawuf. And this is sort of the spiritual traditions that is associated with Islam, kind of the more mystical traditions. And basically, it's sort of confined to a saying, or it can be summarized by a saying, which says that worship God as if you see him. And though you don't see him, know that he sees you. So the idea is that everything that you do in life, it's all being witnessed. It's all being recorded. It's all being seen. And that you ultimately have to account for your actions. And so there's a certain degree of sort of scrupulousness that you try to adopt in how you comport yourself and how you behave and how you do things in the world. And you try to do it to the things that you do. You try to perform kind of your human function. You try to express your humanness, your humanity in the best way possible, because this is something that is befitting the form that you've been made. And so this is something that, you know, it's kind of a basic summary of the tenets of faith, of what sort of makes Islam or defines Islam and the living praxis of a Muslim. The last thing I want to mention is actually, and I think this is something that ties in with the other Abrahamic traditions, is that there's sort of a variant or a variation on the golden rule that is something that defines what Islam is all about. And so we know that within Judaism, there's the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Within Christianity, it's, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Within Islam, it's a little different. It's more of a sort of a conditional statement where your belief is qualified by you fulfilling a certain way of comporting yourself in the world again, as I mentioned earlier. And basically, it's this. It says that none of you truly believes, or your faith is not said to be complete, unless you wish for your brother what you wish for yourself. And in saying what you wish for your brother, what you wish for yourself, it doesn't even necessarily, that's not confined to someone who shares the same faith as you. Your brother is your fellow human being, is your fellow man or your fellow woman. Is that because, again, this is a being that has the same form as you, you come from the same origins, that this is someone who is deserving of the same type of honor that you would want for yourself because your humanity calls for it. And so that, again, that's a basic summary of what it is that is sort of espoused or contained within the faith tradition that's called Islam.
There are many pieces of this that I have never encountered before, and it's really powerful stuff. When I studied Islam from a secular historical perspective, my instructor was very clear about the fact that it's easy to take things out of context or to compare what we see on the news and what we're told with a particular piece of, I want to call it scripture. I don't know how you would address a piece of writing from the Quran, if that would be a proper term.
You could use that.
I'm trying to be precise enough with my language, but I only have so many words to use, which is funny because this is the English language after all, and we have a word for everything, to be respectful in the dialogue. And I really like that idea because of the way that it expresses a universality between people, that whether free will enters into the conversation or not, it appropriately recognizes that we are all made in the same form. And that because of that, regardless of shape or region, nationality, whatever way we might try to divide ourselves into different tribes, that we are all still children of God within the vision of this faith practice. And I think that that's really important to understand because of the way that it brings us together and the way that it is an ethical statement to care for everyone, no exceptions.
I think what's interesting is that, you know, the term that's used to refer to the human being, in Arabic they call it, we're called insan, and we're all said to be descendant from Adam. We're from Bani Adam, or sort of the tribe of Adam, or the family of Adam. So we're all Adamic beings. We all come from the same origin, and Adam was made from clay or made from earth, whereas, you know, we mentioned the jinn, you know, the jinn were said to be made from fire. And the angels were said to be made from light. Now, in talking about the jinn, the origins of the djinn. See, the djinn is the place from which the figure more popularly known in the Christian tradition is Satan, what in Arabic is called Shaitan, or sort of the original Shaitan was a figure called Iblis. Interestingly enough, in the Arabic language, Iblis comes from a root word, ablasa, which is said to mean one who despaired. So Iblis is sort of the figure who despaired sort of the mercy of God after he was said to have sort of disobeyed an order with regard to sort of paying homage to Adam upon his being created. And it was from this slight that Iblis or Shaitan had experienced that kind of set into motion this mortal combat, this kind of adversarial relationship between Iblis and the human being. Because what's believed about Iblis or Shaitan is that he was actually someone who had spent many, many years worshiping God before the creation of Adam, and was a very, very ardent worshiper of God and servant of God. And what happened was that when Adam was created, and it said that the angels were made to bow down to Adam because he had been taught what was said to be the names. He was taught the names of everything in existence. And Iblis didn't want to do it. He wouldn't do it. And he said the reason why he didn't want to do it was that in his mind, he was better than Adam. In spite of the fact that God had said that this is sort of the preferred creation, man. He said, I'm better than man. I'm better than Adam because I'm made from fire and he's made from clay. Now, the interesting thing about that read is that he was sort of assessing the value of Adam based on sort of the substance from which he was made, kind of the physical substance. It wasn't assessed based on what God knew of what it was that he created. It was based on sort of his feeling about what he was made and what Adam was made. So in some ways, this was seen as being sort of the first instance of sort of racism, right? Like, I'm made from fire, he's made from clay. I'm better, why? Because I'm white and you're black. Or I'm better because, you know, I'm, you know, fill in the blank and you're fill in the blank. This was a sort of a value judgment that was being made based on something that's not seen as being worthy of defining the relative worth of two beings. And so this is a theme that sort of continues to play out. It's a pattern, if you will. If we were talking about it in terms of permaculture language, it's a pattern that plays out, you know, throughout history, is that there are value judgments that are made with regard to people or to beings based on measures that would not be seen as being valid ways of ascribing the relative worth of things. It's a really interesting part of sort of that faith tradition, sort of that cosmological understanding of how things are defined or how things are understood, that I think is very powerful because it kind of carries over to a number of other areas.
Does that value judgment apply to the non-human sections of the world as well, or the non-human parts of the world?
What's interesting about that, though, is there has always been a great deal of emphasis put on understanding the proper status of things found within the phenomenal world, found within kind of this reality that we experience. There's an interesting paper that I quoted in a piece that I wrote not long ago. It's actually, I cited an essay that was written by an academic named William Chittick, and it's about a prominent figure within the intellectual tradition of Islam named Ibn al-Arabi. This essay wrote was called Ibn al-Arabi on the Benefit of Knowledge. And so he's talking about, well, what accounts for what would be considered legitimate beneficial knowledge? And so what he starts talking about here is he starts referring to what it is that you just asked me about, is the same understanding kind of applied to other things in existence. And I want to quote a part of this paper because I want to, like, this is a very important point. And he says in this paper, all of creation makes demands upon man because he is created in God's form and has been appointed his vicegerent. So there's this idea that human beings have been placed in a position of vicegerency, what they call in Arabic, khilafa. You kind of like are given this position of having to kind of oversee things, not to dominate things, but you're a steward of the creation. He continues, he has the God-given duty woven into his original created nature to recognize the right of things and to act accordingly. It is this right that must be known if his knowledge is to be true, right, worthy, and appropriate, for this right is identical with the creation that God has established. In short, beneficial knowledge is knowledge of the what and the why of ourselves and of things. In order to know a thing truly and benefit from the knowledge, we need to know what it is, its reality, which is nothing but its creation and its right, and we need to know how we should respond to it. What exactly does it demand from us, rightly, truly, and appropriately? So the idea is that if you understand the proper function and position of each thing that exists, then you can accord to it its just due. You can perform whatever function, you can grant it whatever it demands in the way of its sort of proper treatment and its proper placement within the grand scheme of things. And you can sort of perform your proper function with regard to the form that these things have been put into. And then likewise, you can perform your proper function given the form that you were put into. So everything has a right. And if you give each thing its just due, then really the likelihood of problems arising is very small. If anything, most of the problems that we now experience, we've ever experienced, is a product of our not giving each thing that exists its just due.
So from those thoughts is where we become stewards of the earth within the tradition of Islam?
This idea of stewardship, you know, this idea of the human being as a steward, not as opposed to a dominator, the idea that everything has a right that has to be recognized is very much connected to this understanding of stewardship within the Islamic tradition. And the funny thing is that this has actually been a topic of conversation within the Islamic tradition for centuries. There's actually a book that was written by a group called the Ikhwan al-Safa, or the Brethren of Purity. They had a compendium of, I think it was a total of 52 epistles. And one of them was called The Case of the Animals versus the Men Before the Court of the Jinn. And this book, it's a fascinating book because basically this was sort of a playing out of this whole discussion of, you know, the rights of nature or the rights of man that was literally written probably, this is several hundred years ago. And we're only now having that conversation, you know, in the past handful of years. And this is something that was discussed a very long time ago. This is a book you can get actually from Oxford University Press. And basically, to summarize the story, it's the playing out of a legal case that was brought before a jinn king. This is a king that was from the jinn who ruled over an island or a land that human beings had arrived to where only animals and jinn had inhabited. And it was upon the arrival of the human beings that the trouble began. What happened was the humans, feeling as though they had a right to enslave the animals, there was a complaint that was lodged against these human beings. And so messengers were sent to the two communities, to the humans and to the animals, for this case to be decided in front of this jinn king. Now, the case between the human beings and the animals was all conducted by using source material found within the Quran and within what's called hadith literature, which are the sayings or the traditions of the Prophet Muhammad. And so everything that the humans were using as proof to justify their enslavement of the animals came from those sources. And then everything that the animals had used to argue their case against what the human beings were arguing for came from the same source material. So it's a fascinating read because every time you think the humans have made their point, the animals end up completely obliterating the argument by using the same source material. It's an incredible book. You're reading this book and like, this is amazing. And like literally this book was written probably almost 1,000 years ago. It's remarkable to think that this conversation was taking place. It had already happened. And this is now only sort of in terms of a contemporary topic of discussion. This is considered to be sort of cutting edge discussion now with regard to whether or not, you know, nature has rights. For example, I don't know if you talked to Polly Higgins, but, you know, she's talked about this whole idea of ecocide being a crime that's punishable, you know, on the international stage. Again, this is something that's been talked about for centuries within the Islamic tradition. And I think the unfortunate thing is I think the Muslims, in large part, have overlooked a lot of this history and are unaware of it, because I think they've sort of wrapped themselves up in a lot of these geopolitical discussions now, which dominate the discussion now.
I studied natural resource law and policy last semester as part of my graduate program. And it was one of the things that we got into when arguing policy. There were often times when one of my fellow students would respond to a question in a particular way, and I would wind up using the same source material to argue exactly the opposite point, to continue the conversation to see how people could arrive at different decisions.
Exactly. And I think that gets to the point about, you know, we were saying earlier about intent being very much a critical component of the discussion. Again, intent, and then also contextualizing the discussion within the confines of ethics. So we can have a discussion about law, and we can argue for things that ethically speaking are reprehensible. And we could justify it if we understand the sort of the technical aspects of law, which will allow us to manipulate the source material that we're using to justify our unethical stances if we understand the mechanics of how law operates. And that's, I mean, everything that influences our lives now are colored by those types of discussions, is that you have really great technicians, really great legal technicians. But from an ethical standpoint, it's like they're completely indefensible what a lot of people are arguing for now in terms of, you know, legally speaking, you know, like legally justifying things like torture. Right. You know, like these are serious discussions that, quote unquote, intellectual people are having now, is torturing people from the standpoint of it being legally sanctioned. But if we were to reference that against ethics, like there's no way you could talk about torturing people. But it's not about ethics anymore. It's about how great and how adept a technician you are, you know, to argue for these things. So it's really about if you have an agenda and your ability to argue for your agenda is predicated on your skill as a technician, right? So it has nothing to do with anyone being an ethicist in any way, shape, or form. And I think, you know, this is very much connected to the discussion we're having now, is that it's unfortunately a lot of what we're dealing with is a product of ethics no longer being seen as something of value or something worth talking about. Like ethics are a quaint idea that its time has passed. You know, it's something that's outmoded.
I also think that when we're talking about ethics and law in this conversation, there's a certain precision that we're using for the meanings that we take in using those words in this dialogue between the two of us in the context of this particular conversation. And this goes back to something that we talked about before we started the interview about the cultural context in which we're raised and the way that that gives us an understanding of the world. And that I think that in the modern context in the last decade or so, that if something is legal, it's also viewed as being ethical.
Right, exactly. The two are seen as being immediately synonymous when that assumption is, I think, anybody who's serious about having a discussion about law can see that ethics have been largely separated from discussions about law. And it's really about what you can get away with. The discussions about law is really about what can I legally get away with? Like what will keep me from landing myself in jail? Right. Or, you know, being prosecuted within a court of law, what will allow for me to be able to kind of pass under the radar of being possibly punished for doing something that I likely shouldn't be doing. And there's so much that's happening now that, you know, most financial dealings completely fall underneath that category. Even things like, you know, I was just watching, you know, a couple of news clips about this new TAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, all this discussion about, you know, these trade agreements that are now going to take place between Europe and the United States and the United States and Asia, and, you know, which is essentially what they call NAFTA on steroids, right? Like what's going to happen now that, you know, there's total complete deregulation in trade agreements. you know, or financial dealings, all of these things. There are ways to sort of, quote unquote, legally justify doing these things. But when you look at all everything that's involved with the activities that fall within the cat, you know, underneath the umbrella of those agreements, I mean, they're things that are, again, ethically speaking, that are absolutely reprehensible. You know, you run the whole gamut. But that's not the point. There isn't really any concern about, you know, about the ethics that are attached to these things. The ethical discussion doesn't have any value. It doesn't have any function with regard to what's seen as having value or being important, to the people that have put together these, you know, these types of arrangements.
I don't remember who said it to me, but I know this is a conversation that I have with my children quite often. And it's that just because you can do it doesn't mean you should.
Absolutely.
In the dark after I picked my kids up from school as we're driving home, just because my daughter can hit her brother and I can't see it.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that you should. But the funny thing is, I think this gets back to, you know, what I was saying before about this concept within Islam called ihsan. You know, this idea of like worship God as if you see him, right? Or live your life as if you are always being seen. Because there's an understanding that everything that you do, you have to answer for it, right? And that there are certain activities or there's certain actions which you can be punished for. There are a lot of these things, there are very specific punishments that are attached to certain types of what would seem as being not impermissible behavior. But you're trying to do things, you know, in a beautiful way is not necessarily fueled by a fear of punishment, that really your actions are being motivated by an expression of gratitude, right? And that by not violating, you know, certain precepts, certain ways of being, by not violating those rules, by not overstepping those bounds, that it's an expression of gratitude and thankfulness for the form that you've been put into, again, in being a human being. So again, stealing is not seen as being something befitting a human being, right? Lying is not seen as being something befitting the nobility that is infused in the human form. Destroying nature is something that is not befitting the nobility that is infused in the human form. And then ultimately, it ends up actually undermining the very foundations upon which the human being's ability to exist in the world. It ends up undermining your own, you know, the foundations of what allows you to live, you know, shooting yourself in the foot. So, you know, you're ultimately, you don't gain anything by doing that. Eventually it all catches up to you. So there is this understanding that, you know, even if you're trying to get away with breaking the rules, you know, quote unquote, even if you win, you lose. You don't gain anything by it. If anything, you end up diminishing yourself. Because when you track these actions on a continuum over a long enough period of time, eventually it catches up to you. And so you're much better off by making sure you do things in the correct manner or in the right way so that you don't take anything away from your ability to exist in an ideal manner or in a beautiful manner. You actually take the time to do things correctly so that you, in the long run, make things better for yourself. You are able to more approximate the ideal.
And in turn, you create more abundance and can work from a place of delight and joy rather than fear and scarcity. And not only are you able to wish upon others what you would want for yourself, you're also able to grant that to them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's interesting about this is, you know, to kind of really try to center this more squarely within sort of the confines of permaculture. I mean, one of the texts I often use as sort of historical evidence of this idea being brought to life is there's a really great book by an author named Dr. G.T. Wrench. And you might be familiar with it. It was, you know, it's a book called Reconstruction by Way of the Soil. It was written in 1943. And it's sort of this running account of sort of this historical continuum relating sort of the successes and failures of human civilization with regard to the stewardship of land, the management of land, and specifically within the confines of agriculture or the husbandry of land. So it goes through all of these different historical periods, all of these different, you know, civilizations, you know, around the world, pretty much every continent. And then eventually, invariably, most of the historical accounts ends in some kind of disastrous way to where basically the land has been destroyed. You know, all the resources have been used up. you know, the soils are depleted, there are problems with water, you know, there's famine and starvation and all of these, you know, people like Jared Diamond have written about this and, you know, in Collapse, or Carter and Dale's book, Topsoil and Civilization, or David Montgomery's book, which is Dirt, which is, I think, more or less kind of a retelling of that account in Carter and Dale's book. But in G.T. Wrench's book, he gets to chapter 21 of the book, and he ends up arriving at a historical example that's very different than all of what came before it. And he says, when you read accounts of what took place in this particular historical example, it doesn't even seem real. And to kind of cut to the chase, the place he's talking about is actually Moorish Spain, or what's more popularly known as Muslim Spain. And this would be between the early 8th century and the late 15th century. And there's some amazing historical accounts that are talked about, which give you a picture of what took place there. And what many of the historians refer to, how they refer to what was seen in Muslim Spain, is they call it agricultural art. They call it farming art, the type of management of natural resources and husbandry that was found in this place. And then as a result of their success with these agricultural systems, it gave birth to this, you know, to this incredible civilization, which ended up fueling or giving birth to the Renaissance in Europe. And the civilization was seen as being completely founded on this development of this beautiful agricultural system that was created. And to put some numbers to this, it's said that during the time that this particular period of history in Spain, where the Muslims were there, it said at its height, they had a population of about 30 million people. And this population was actually more than the four largest European countries put together at the time, which would have been, it was England, France, Germany, and I'll find it in just a moment. Italy. England, France, Germany, and Italy. Basically, it said between these four countries, they had a total population of 15 to 20 million people compared to 30 million in Spain. So it's like, okay, well, in order to support a population of 30 million people, what was going on there? What were the systems that were created that would have allowed for a population like that to exist, where everybody's needs would be met? And basically, there was no worry of whether or not there's going to be enough. A lot of what came out of the investigation of what was developed there ended up being condensed down to a discussion of, well, what were the ethics that guided the formation of this system? And so then when he gets to the next chapter in this book, it's actually a retelling of the history of the emergence of Islam, because what he wanted to see was, okay, well, what was the story? Like, what were the origins of the ethics that created the system that allowed for this flourishing of human civilization that had previously not been seen before?
And that was Ramis Kent. I don't have a lot to add to this conversation at the moment, as I'm planning to do a longer discussion after the end of this series of interviews with Ramis. Whether that's going to be one or two more, I don't know yet. However, I will remark that while listening to Ramis, I was reminded of the stories and teachings in my own childhood, and how similar people really are to one another. We have a desire for peace, kinship, and kindness, to be treated like human beings. It's incredible to me how small the differences are that so often are used to divide us. I'd rather focus on what brings us together, wouldn't you? Wherever you stand after listening to all this, I'd like to hear from you. Email me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or join in the discussions on Facebook, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or follow me on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. And for those of you who are used to how these shows normally end, you'll notice I didn't include the phone number in that first set. And that's because if there's any reason you would like to reach out to me, if there's anything I can do to help you with your path regarding permaculture, please feel free to call me. That's usually the best way to get in touch with me. That number is 717-827-6266. Though I'm not always around to answer the phone when a call comes in, I will call you back as soon as I can. From here, the next episode of the show is a Q&A with Wilson Alvarez and Ben Wise, where they answer some listener questions about tending the wild. That will be out on Friday, January 24th. The next full interview is out on January 27th and is with Eric Puro of thepush.org and that organization's work to build sustainable projects around the world. Then will be Wayne Herring back for a Q&A about small-scale farming, which will come out on January 31st. You can find a full listing of upcoming shows, which are now plotted out through May 2014, by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com and clicking on Release Schedule. While you're there, if you've missed anything from the past, you can also check out the show archives. I continue to fill in that information as I'm able to, working towards having a full listing of the past episodes, which will wrap up this show. Until the next time, take care of the Earth, yourself, and each other. And that little bit of legal. The Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann is released under Creative Commons, Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Feel free to share it, but let people know where you got it from, and don't change or sell it. This was episode 2014-004.